morning. My name is Michael McCusker. As the diverse populations of the world move increasingly toward a world civilization, elements in every society resist and clamor violently for separation and for racial and cultural purification. In country after country, obstinate, bigoted, or fanatical fringe groups and individuals resist with the power that brutality and terrorism bestow. Hatred and intolerance are on the rise worldwide. Falsifiers of history and theology exhort masses to exterminate minorities. A virulence never at rest, even when periodically subdued by revulsion of its excesses. Genocide wears a cosmetic of ethnic cleansing. Peace-loving peoples commit genocide upon neighbors. Large parts of the world act as laundries for ethnic cleansing. Countries or persons who publicly declare themselves as peace-loving are often as vicious as wanton, nightmarish beasts. Peace is not on the earth, but a few feet under it for millions. Life for so many of our human brethren is the hell the pious claim the providence of sinners after life. The pious are too often responsible for the living hell so many endure on earth. Genocidal advocates deny the Holocaust of European Jewry, yet intend the same to appease their own prejudicial bigotries. In the United States, the ancient and atrocious issue of white supremacy and political primacy, the persecution of other races and of religions not puritanically Christian, is once more a major theme of American exceptionalism. It is the far right that now talks of revolution, that sets up paramilitary training camps, patterning its concepts and plans for white revolt on a fictional account of Aryan revolution that was written by a disaffected University of Oregon physics professor half a century ago. And with a surprising suddenness with the fluky rise of the abominable Donald Trump, it seems as if the complex fabric of democracy, tolerance, and human rights in the United States is threatened with collapse in the U.S. of A., resulting from unchecked corruption, deception, and malice, despite Trump's forthcoming ejection from the presidency. The so-called alt-right holds rallies in several American cities for the single purpose of spreading fear and hatred and to create havoc and violence, which are nearly identical blueprints of early Nazi tactics that undermined the post-World War I Weimar Republic in Germany. White supremacist racists shield their hate speech with the First Amendment, which would be among the first freedoms squelched if they prevail in their rabid usurpation of universal creeds of liberty and justice. The more dangerous bigots are those who think they are not prejudiced, the everyday folk who resent changes made by immigrants or multiracial newcomers into their communities, which in this part of the world were only recently established by displacing earlier communities. These good, decent, ordinary folk disclaim any unwarranted prejudice, yet their complaints about differences of color or culture of their new neighbors are the same as bigots have used to inflame hatred and genocide for millennia. The prejudice against gays and lesbians is the same root fear of change as the dread of racial and cultural imposition by immigrants. Perennially labeled citizens groups, and that's a quote, formed to deny newcomers common rights and protections, as though fools, bigots, and goons are the only worthy citizenry. The so-called Christian right invokes a whitewashed cultural, theolytical return to a Norman Rockwell past that never existed, except in the miasmic psyches of Trumpian Morlocks. Ethnic cleansing is not a stranger to America. And I wrote that. And now I will read something else I wrote. A Short History of the Millennium. Very few of humanity's billions will ever be remembered for very long or be recorded for more than village histories. And the names who momentarily preoccupy our era will as surely vanish. Of our rapidly fluid epoch, which encompasses parts of two millennia, perhaps only Hitler and Gandhi might remain long in the future as icons of our dark and light, and Einstein, who asked two compelling questions that altered our cosmology. Where am I? How am I moving? All the rest is E equals MC squared. Only recently have women's claims to history been taken seriously, and in Western society, it is difficult to entertain any other than a Caucasian cosmogony. The epic human struggle is usually portrayed as East against West, of yellow peril against white is right, of crescent against cross, and both against Judaism. Black and white are absolutely incompatible. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter at each of history's pages for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost, only the numbers are marked, aggregates of immense folly and depravity. Man is born, suffers, and dies, is a legendary crystallization of Egypt's long ancient history, and might elliptically be the essential history of humanity. The German Count Gottlieb von Hassler enlarged the thought toward the end of the 19th century when he said, unconsciously anticipating the world wars of the 20th century, "It is necessary that our civilization build its temple on a mountain of corpses, on an ocean of tears, and on the death cries of men without number." A major significant fact about this transmillennial epoch is its mountains of corpses laid out at civilization's temple as the purpose or outcome of its greatest scientific and technological creations. At the very heart of the temple are the death camps of World War II, which names will very likely reverberate with a shudder up through the centuries: Auschwitz, Treblinka, Dachau. Simultaneously, the purpose of splitting the atom to obliterate large numbers of the human species might cause future humanity, however bountiful nuclear energy, to regard its second millennium progenitors as, at least as barbaric, we regard our cave-dwelling forebears. A paradox that underlies history is that the eras of greatest creativity and discovery are also the most dangerous. The 8 decades since World War II are unparalleled in advances of knowledge and productivity, comparable to the entirety of the previous 10 millennia, and human culture has consequently structured technologies that are disintegrating civilization, even as contemporary civilized life owes its existence to them. Science is most obviously the Pied Piper this era dances to. Science and its handmaiden technology modernized civilization by routinely ripping away its fabric without making much effort to repair it in the kaleidoscopic surge into an incomprehensible future. This is the point at which history is declared dead, without significant meaning or impact except as memory and latent nostalgia, because it is claimed to no longer have any bearing or effect on present or future. The race is to the swift who disregard consequences. The present is patently obsolete as it careens into the future. Although human progress is typically measured through technical prowess and achievement, it should at least be as important to concentrate on the contradictory evolution of human rights and freedoms and the painfully slow development toward a world civilization free of despotism and tyranny. Like it or not, humanity is a global species, overcrowding into every accommodatable space on the planet. Humanity eternally pushes at the edge of evolution, impatiently and recklessly remaking the natural world into its own image, meanwhile overturning nature as well, perhaps the major consistency in our history is our disdain for our only natural enemy. The natural world in which we have spent the great majority of our history, though it is mostly unrecorded, is regarded as an adversary to be overcome and altered to our design, whether domesticating grains and animals to cloning them and ourselves. The reality of attaining an equitable world civilization will obviously be much more rough and tumble than is generally the vision, given the dyspepsia of our ill-tempered species. Yet the rising tectonic turbulence by impoverished, overcrowded, and cruelly governed masses of humanity is a basic struggle for a decent life on this planet. The most ancient desire to be a part of a community, not enslaved by it, might very well readjust the center of power and pioneer the first truly universal human community in its long evolution. Universal amalgamation might provide the basis for human diaspora beyond a home planet that is rapidly changing into a hostile world. The fact that we have already started the process of making Earth unlivable for our species and others, there is yet a near future of many more generations who will be forced to live on a dying world bequeathed by callously reckless predecessors. By abandoning our heirs so that the present dwellers of Mother Earth can live in comfort might be a just rationale for nuclear extinction. More placid possibilities than self-ruin are that we reconfigure our DNA with electrical impulsation into the human neural system, a robotization that has been hailed as humanity's next great evolution, the bionic transformation out of biology. A way might be found to keep the world's masses of poor people alive and healthy in exchange for body parts and internal organs for rich folk. Herds of healthy poor can be kept available for harvest in a future dystopian collapse. Male humans might become extinct as a result of biological and reproductive irrelevancy. The cold reality is that women can survive as the lone gender and continue to perpetuate the species female, as well as the busy work necessary for survival of anthropological disaster. Nuclear weapons rendered the nation-state dead as dinosaurs, despite the recurrent regressive xenophobic rise of nationalist sentiment, such as the atavistic Make America Great Again, convulsing United States politics. A world civilization encompasses billions of human beings, leaving out a trillion other living organisms, several of which humanity has more rapidly made extinct or endangered the past 100 years than at any time earlier. But everything has accelerated as well as the human birth rate and population sprawl that seems to have no end in sight. More babies are born every day than dead left to make room for them. And that despite daily baby mortality worldwide from hunger, poor medicine, and incessant warfare, humanity overflows Earth like maggots on a peach. The human fabric is interwoven from billions of diverse threads that dissolve into everybody moving around at random with no apparent distinguishable themes as they bump into each other. Just billions of ordinary persons doing individually what they wish or feel obliged to do, without patterns large enough to frame, swarming like protozoa in a drop of water. The sum total of human works does not equal, in all parts put together, the achievements of the life forms of plant and insect in a square foot of grass, the writer Philip Wiley said in 1968. The true millennium this era ordains really started in the middle of the 20th century, when humanity cracked the atom. It was also a moment when human beings realized this cosmic power they unleashed from its locks might be the doom of humanity. It was one of those rare moments that seemed as if everything before that moment was inexorably directed toward it, and afterward will be as measured from it. Quite like it will be with us on the Pacific Northwest coast when the Cascadia earthquake and tsunami rupture our lives sooner than later, at any minute now. Humanity's sly calculation of time might not fit any other world than its own, and even so is a compromise between observation and superstition. This beginning of an early year of the third millennium of a parochial calendar might be an opportunity to reassess a few perceptions of human reign over our very small, fragile, crowded planet. It really makes little sense to fear the future. After all, it is where we will spend the rest of our lives. Every moment is new, like waves from an immense ocean. Each second an uncertainty unexplored and doubtful, and as instantly history, irretrievable except in memory and myth. Arthur Rimbaud wrote, "At dawn, armed with burning patience, we shall enter the splendid cities." And Samuel Beckett, "You must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on." And that was something I wrote, A Short History of the Millennium, now 21 years. And now, by Timothy Egan, the next 3 months are going to be pure hell. Lessons from Lewis and Clark on living through the darkest days and longest nights. Every 5 years or so, I try to return to Land's End, the continent's edge where the Columbia River empties into the Pacific Ocean, the final heave of the River of the West. I prefer to go during winter solstice, the long night of the soul in the Northern Hemisphere. Off Cape Disappointment, you look out at swells of 20 feet and struggle to walk in the face of a resolute rain and wind gusts that slap you silly. It's exhilarating. This year, the mouth of the Columbia serves up a metaphor for these awful times. No, not the shipwreck of the Peter Iredale, embedded offshore since 1906, just to the south of the mouth. The hollowed-out skeleton of that four-masted steel bark seems too obvious a symbol of the United States in President Trump's final weeks. The better metaphor is the story of the existential crisis that bedeviled Lewis and Clark's ragged crew just after they got their first glimpse of the Pacific in November 1805. They were facing an endless and desperate winter in a place they knew nothing about. But first they took a vote on where to build their winter camp. In their crew, York, a slave, and Sacagawea, a native woman and former slave, were both given a voice on this occasion. The decision was made to cross the Columbia and hunker down near what is now Astoria, Oregon. That episode comes with plenty of asterisks. Upon his return, William Clark did not free the enslaved man who had been allowed a momentary vote in the wild. He was property, as before. If any attempt is made by York to run off or refuse to perform his duty as a slave, I wish him sent to New Orleans and sold, he wrote after the expedition had ended. And Sacagawea, the only woman in the Corps of Discovery, the special U.S. Army unit led by Lewis and Clark, and the mother of an infant that she carried to the Pacific and back, was initially denied a chance to see the ocean until she insisted. But as a lesson in our coming catastrophe, a season which could be the most difficult time in the public health history of this nation, as Robert Redfield, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says, the winter of 1805 to 1806 is instructive. The task of that mildewed crew was to stay alive and alert until the spring, when they planned to return. You can imagine the descent toward misery. The explorers recorded only a dozen days without rain. As Clark wrote, "Oh, how disagreeable is our situation during this dreadful weather." For his part, Meriwether Lewis appears to have suffered from bouts of severe depression throughout his life. 3 years after completing the expedition, he died at the age of 35 of gunshot wounds, what most historians agree was a likely suicide. I fear the weight of his mind has overcome him, Clark wrote after hearing the news. During the coronavirus pandemic, the number of adults exhibiting symptoms of depression has tripled and alcohol consumption has risen. We are prisoners of our homes and our minds, Zoom fatigued, desperate for social contact. As a nation, we are diminished and exhausted, and millions remain out of work. Further, it has been a long fall from that crude but egalitarian vote at the mouth of the Columbia to one that is among the nadirs of democracy, when 60% of Republican House members joined a court effort this month to negate the sovereign right of the people to elect their leaders. Vladimir Putin acknowledged Joe Biden's victory before Mitch McConnell did. It is equally troubling that Biden won the popular vote by 7 million, but came within 43,000 votes of losing the election because of the anti-democratic relic of the Electoral College. The Corps of Discovery made it back without losing a person. One man died during the westward half of the expedition. They fared well once they emerged from their long winter. We, on the other hand, face a brutal early spring. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation projects that more than 500,000 Americans likely will have died from COVID-19 by the end of March. Dr. Anthony Fauci has made similar grim assessments of what lies ahead. In November, he predicted December would see a surge superimposed upon a surge, not unlike the waves of the Pacific, gray and unrelenting in the December dusk. Still, we look to the spring as did they. We rely on our ingenuity as did they. Even as we mourn the dead, we cheer the first people to get a shot in the arm. I feel like healing is coming, said Sandra Lindsay, the Long Island nurse who had the distinction of becoming the first to be vaccinated on our shores after getting her coronavirus inoculation. We cling to the coming spring because it's far better than thinking about tomorrow's dreary sameness. We look forward to a new president and the return of the simple joy of human touch. But before that, we need to be psychologically ready for 3 months of pure hell. How to get through it? Hibernation, taking a cue from our fellow warm-blooded mammals, looking inward, discovering the nuance and overlooked dimensions of things long neglected. And in a sliver of advice from words attributed to the Irish writer Edna O'Brien, that winter is the real spring. And that was by Timothy Egan. The next 3 months are going to be pure hell. And he is the writer who writes about the environment, the American West, and politics. He is a winner of the National Book Award and the author most recently of A Pilgrimage to Eternity. He lives in Seattle, and he wrote this for the New York Times. And now, a new poem by Jim Dott of Astoria, an annual tradition for this bifurcated time of years. And with each poem, a descriptive illustration by his daughter, May Lee, this of two ravens coupled in flight. Birds into rain. For years, no dreams of flying until last night. Not an airplane in steep dive, head between knees, but a raptor's long soar above the forest, then down over our town, our street, our house, breeze sweeping back hair, chilling the skin, arms tilting to bank and veer. Such pure elation. Solace from false conspiracies and wishful, slipshod thinking. If it could be true, it must be true. That would appall, then depress my father, a scientist, who worked all his life for clear, sound reasoning, glad he's not here to witness these times. After hours trying to gather a poem, its sprawl too scattered to rake in, each verse a joke refusing a punchline, I go out before night swallows this shortest day. No flight, just a slog into the woods, up a muddy trail that peters out in waist-high sword fern. I wade in, hoping to find peace or maybe a poem. A raven calls from high in the hemlocks, any answer washed away in a siege of rain, and then it's over. Cloud spills downslope, makes ghosts of the trees. Chestnut-backed chickadees condense into the brush, whir and chip, foraging in a leafless salmonberry, their food too tiny for me to see, then gone up the draw, soaked into the undergrowth. One warbler, who must have flocked with them, stays behind, stares at me from a twig tip, flits down to a puddle formed where I had stepped, drinks and wings after them. Not lost, but not getting where I meant to go, I turn and head back down. When I come to the road, it begins to rain. The clouds are torn open over the river, the water brightly lit. That raven glides into view, but then parts into two ravens. One sweeps its wing across the others, like water over stone. The other does the same. They bank toward the river. If I could, I would follow them into the rain. And that was by Jim Dodd, Birds into Rain. And this is Michael McCusker. Dylan Houser, Schalk, engineers today's program. An old tweet by Lindsey Graham has resurfaced in Twitter world. If we nominate Trump, we will get destroyed and we will deserve it. While an increasingly desperate Donald Trump commits despotic acts of insurrection and even treachery to remain in the White House, which prompts thoughts of a second impeachment to prevent him from ever becoming president again, his weaselly defenders perhaps mask a greater concern, that an Asian black woman sets a potent precedent as the new vice president of the USA. And speaking of beacons for the future, happy 18th birthday this past Sunday, January 3rd, to Greta Thunberg. She is not a Swedish nightingale, but instead a Swedish canary in a quarry, warning humanity of the consequences of ravaging and putrefying Mother Gaia. She vanguards the world's children to save the world they hope to live in. She is the beauty to Trump's beast in everything good and true. And for your own near future and everyone else's, continue to lock down and mask up. This new year of plague can wipe out anyone's future in a breath.